welcome to the other Bundesliga, Jesse Marsch. Salzburg may have a new coach all the way from the USA, but there were still six Bundesliga games to review and a whole lot more action for this week's episode. Welcome to another episode of the Other Bundesliga podcast. My name's Tom Midler, and I'm joined here in the studio today by Lee Wingate.
Guten Abend.
And Simon Clark.
Hello, Thomas.
And we're lucky enough to be joined today by some experts from the United States of America, because the breaking news in Austrian football from this week is that with the departure of Marco Rose as manager of Red Bull Salzburg, his replacement, his successor, is now announced as Jesse Marsch, the current assistant coach at sister Red Bull team Leipzig. So without further ado, we're going to speak to Joseph Goldstein from the Seeing Red podcast, a New York Red Bulls podcast, and see what his take is on the appointment of Jesse Marsch. From your perspective, you're in the US. How surprising was this appointment, and has it made the news over there?
It did make the news over here, and I don't think there was a tremendous amount of surprise. I think when Jesse Marsch first moved over to Leipzig, there was an understanding that he may be getting groomed to take over the Salzburg role. The position was up in the air, knowing that Marco Rose was going to be leaving. And we know that the Red Bull organization is very high on Jesse Marsch and what he was able to do in New York. So we weren't really that surprised, and we're all kind of happy to see him, you know, move on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, and going back to that time in New York, what was his reputation like over there, and what did he achieve in his time as a manager there?
Well, coming in, he had a lot to sort of own up to. He was replacing a sort of fan favorite and a club icon in Mike Petke, who had won the New York Red Bulls their first significant trophy, the Supporters' Shield, which is the prize given to the team that accumulates the most points at the end of the season in MLS. So he had a lot to kind of overcome. And in that first season, he did tremendously well. He earned them another supporter shield, and the team looked like they were on the verge of winning the playoffs for, you know, the first time in their history. Over the course of the next, you know, 3.5 seasons that he was with the club, they continued to do very well. They were always a contender at the top of the East. They promoted a lot of young academy players, which is a difficult thing for MLS teams to do with any kind of regularity. And I think Jesse Marsch deserves a lot of credit for showing trust in those players and allowing them to kind of grow and make mistakes in the game while not really sacrificing position on the table. Because of that work, a lot of other teams now in MLS are starting to sort of emulate that model.
What about the brand of football that they played at Red Bull New York under his leadership? Because the Red Bull school of football is very much based about this quick transition from defence to attack, this high pressing game. Was that something that he implemented there, or did he have his own style?
That was very much what he implemented. There was a couple of occasions where they looked to play a little bit more possession and try to break down teams that would then bunker to sort of counteract that approach. But for the most part, they maintained that, you know, high press, look to create those moments in transition and get shots or at least chances as quick as possible once they were gaining possession.
This isn't actually the first time that that Jesse Marsch has been linked with the Salzburg role. There were media reports in 2017 before Marco Rose came in that he was a contender, but he was not obviously appointed at that time. What do you think might have changed in that time, and what do you think might have convinced Red Bull Salzburg to give him a go now?
Well, I think based on what he accomplished in New York and growing players like Tyler Adams, that the club became a lot more comfortable in the idea of trying to transition him to the next level. He, in sort of I don't know if we could call it a coup necessarily, but there was a disagreement between the general manager and Jesse heading into the 2017 season. And based on the outcome of that, it seemed very clear that Red Bull was sort of trusting Jesse with not just the coaching side, but the full sporting side of the game, despite the fact that Dennis Hamlett was appointed as sort of the sporting director. And the results that he was able to accomplish there, I think, gave them confidence that he would be able to continue growing. And he was getting his UEFA license at the time. So I think there was a little bit of sort of a waiting out period of when he would be available and fit.
Do you think now we're going to see him start to sort of take Europe by storm, or is this a guy that wants to get this experience under his belt at managing at a league like the Austrian League, where you can manage with a certain level of pressure but not too much pressure on the main European stage, and perhaps move back to the US later in his career to take maybe the US men's national team job?
I think that's something that if it came up, he would absolutely jump at. But I know, based on, you know, conversations with him, that he wants to continue to grow in that managerial role and continue to compete at the highest levels in Europe. So I think his ambitions are to get to the highest point possible for him. But again, if the U.S. manager's job was open, I think that it would be very attractive and hard for him to turn down.
So maybe that's something for him for the future. Well, what we hope for here over in Austria is that U.S. interest in Austrian soccer now skyrockets and goes through the roof, and everybody wants to listen to us on the other Bundesliga. So hopefully we'll be back in touch with you again during the next season, and we can talk more about how well Jesse Marsch gets on in Salzburg.
I definitely think that there's at least a contingent in the New York, New Jersey area who will be keeping a close eye on how he does there.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Joseph Goldstein there from the Seeing Red podcast. We also have another US soccer pundit joining us as a guest on this week's episode, and that's Joe Gould, also known as the 12th Yank.
Hey, guys.
Joe, can you tell us a bit more about Jesse Marsch's background?
Yeah, Jesse Marsch has now made a very impressive step for American coaching. This is an exciting opportunity for Marsch, who is one of the most highly rated American coaches that exists right now. He's currently plying his coaching trade at RB Leipzig. He's been there for the last year. And helping to guide them to their current position in the German Bundesliga table, which is third. Marsch has a long playing history, mostly at DC United in Major League Soccer, but he also has an impressive coaching resume already. In 2010, 2011, he was the assistant coach to Bob Bradley for U.S. Soccer. After that, he went to Montreal Impact in Major League Soccer for a couple years and eventually made his way into the Red Bull family, where he coached for New York Red Bulls from 2015 to 2018. In his first season in charge in New York, he was the MLS Coach of the Year. And after deciding to step down from his position, he left to go to RB Leipzig in 2018, where he's been doing very well. He's always had an interest in gaining as much coaching pedigree as he could. He would often leave during his time in the Red Bulls to go take coaching courses over in Europe. The RB Salzburg job provides unique opportunity for an American coach. He would be the first American coach to ever coach in the Champions League group stages if he can do it with Salzburg. This would be a monumentous occasion for American coaching. Especially for his resume, he's definitely one of the coaches that a lot of people see in line to be the next U.S. men's national team coach. I think through some discussions that happened, he declined that opportunity. He was more interested in gaining more experience, which for a lot of fans can only be a good thing. In terms of his career plan, I definitely think that he would like to see out his contract and time at Salzburg. The pressure will be on. The fans in the club will want him to continue to bring home the hardware, meaning the trophies. After that, it's possible that we could see him deciding to head back to the U.S. And what role that would be remains, again, to be seen. He's done a lot for Major League Soccer already to help heighten the level of the league here. So it's quite possible that after his tenure at Salzburg, he could be the next U.S. men's national team coach, especially if things don't go according to plan for the current national team coach, Greg Berhalter. He's worked closely with one of the top American prospects who followed in his shoes. We're talking about Tyler Adams here, who has left New York Red Bulls and now plays for RB Leipzig. And those two have a great bond, and Tyler Adams is one of the most highly rated U.S. players to come through the Major League Soccer ranks, and Jesse Marsch was a huge part of that. So he definitely has the ability to help develop talent and to play with a fun attacking style. So I think Salzburg fans will be very pleased with what he could bring to the table. The pressure will definitely be on, but I think he's someone who can rise to the occasion.
Thanks a lot for that input. That's Joe Gould there in Cincinnati, Ohio. and opening things up to you guys here in the studio, what are your thoughts? You know, this is the biggest team in the league. A change of manager is always going to be a big story in Austrian football. How did you feel about the appointment? Was this the successor that you expected?
No, I don't think it was. But then again, it was very expected considering how close the ties have become between RB Leipzig and Red Bull Salzburg. So many players are going in between the two. 20 players, right?
19
as it stands. And now the assistant manager coming to become the head coach. And of course,
coming from Red Bulls as well in New York. So he's staying within the family.
Yeah, he must be the first coach to have coached Red Bulls in New York, Leipzig and in Salzburg. It keeps him in the system. All the Red Bull teams play a certain way. I don't think he'll bring anything like brand new, but
does Salzburg need anything brand new right now? Serial champions?
Well, he is going to have his work cut out, isn't he? Because if you think about some of the players that are going to be leaving this summer, top scorer Munas Dabur, Hannes Wolf as well, I think is going. And he'll be the 20th player heading up to Leipzig. So he's not going to have an easy task. I just say that I'm happy that they didn't poach Oliver Glasner, because that was really my fear. As soon as, you know, this mentality of the big clubs in Europe, the likes of Bayern, the likes of the Juve, it just becomes a trend that you try and poach the best possible candidates from your rival, and I was really worried that Glasner was going to leave last.
Yeah, any team weakening their direct rivals with an appointment like that is always a bit disappointing, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. Well, it seems to me like a perfectly sensible appointment, to be honest. You know, he's another young up-and-coming coach. He seems to be keen to build his experience. There was talk, actually, that he was in the frame for the US national team job last time, and he sort of stepped away from it and said, no, I'm looking for a new change. I'm looking for something else in Europe. And people kind of got on his back a bit at that time about stepping down from being a manager to being an assistant manager. But in terms of his coaching career, I think it just shows that he's a forward-thinking guy. He's looking to build new experiences and get a lot more under his belt and basically progress as a coach rather than just jump straight into the top job. And that's something we're seeing a bit more of lately as well. You know, we've heard these sound bites from Julian Nagelsmann as well, who's rebuffed Real Madrid, for example. And it just seems like a bit more of a sensible long-term strategy. So I, for one, I'm looking forward to it. And I'm really looking forward to having an American coach in the Bundesliga.
Yeah, worth mentioning that he's going to become like already the most notable American manager in European football. There was David Wagner at Huddersfield. He did a great job getting into the Premier League. And obviously he's going to go into a bigger job when that job comes around. But as it stands, he's now the foremost American coach to have ever managed in European soccer. So,
and he hasn't even managed a game yet.
Exactly, yeah.
In Europe. Well, he'll be thrown in at the deep end, that's for sure, because it looks like Red Bull Salzburg will be in the Champions League next season, given the rules and regulations. If the winner of this season's Champions League already has a Champions League qualification spot through their own national league, which surely will be the case, then it looks like Red Bull Salzburg will get a direct entry into the group stages of next season's Champions League. So, could be a baptism of fire for Jesse Marsch. The Red Bull Salzburg fans this weekend, though, they had some banners of protest against the appointment of Jesse Marsch. Were you surprised to see that?
Well, I think could have something to do with the fact that he has a very close relationship with Ralf Rangnick, who since his departure from Salzburg hasn't been the most popular figure. That's just one potential explanation.
Is that because of those 20 players that have gone from Salzburg Richtung Leipzig?
Could well be, but I think Rangnick is a man who, you know, he says what he thinks, doesn't he? You only need to look at his pre-announcement of Marco Rose's departure about 10 days ago to see that. So that could be a reason. But otherwise, maybe people are just generally sceptical of US coaches because there aren't many. I think that's kind of a natural human reaction to react with scepticism to something new.
Yeah, we saw that with Bob Bradley as well when he managed his whole 11 games in the Premier League. He never really got off his back, to be honest. The fact that actually these guys are kind of blazing a trail for themselves in Europe and almost, for want of a better word, sort of pioneering their way through. You know, up until recently, so few players had really played in Europe from the US, and now it's becoming a bit more normal. Perhaps that's going to be the case with coaches soon as well. Anyway, Marco Rose is still in charge of Red Bull Salzburg at the moment. Their side beat Sturm Graz 3-1 this weekend, despite those protests, and also despite going behind in that game. I thought they were rather unlucky to find themselves 1-0 down, but that's what they did.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a shock when Michael Lemmer popped up after Sandy Lovridge's lovely little ball into the box. Lemmer took two touches and he smoothly passed into the net. And I mean, it wasn't expected.
No, it came from a Red Bull Salzburg throw-in as well. They had a defensive throw-in, which they made a bit of a hash of, didn't they?
Yeah, they did make a hash of it. And I mean, before that, Takumi Minamino had hit the post after a delicious chip, which came off the far post. It was a shock lead at halftime for Sturm Graz.
But the second half was really dominated by a very young player, an 18-year-old Dominik Szoboszlai. He was very impressive, wasn't he?
He was very impressive. He had two assists and scored the third goal. The first goal was just as simple as you like. It was a brilliant cross from the far left edge of the box. And Fredrik Gulbrandsen, he couldn't miss, could he? Just from 2-3 yards out.
No, Mensah fell asleep at the back post for Sturm Graz and allowed Gulbrandsen to just ghost in front of him and tuck that ball away. Nice ball through. A bit of luck about Szoboszlai's second assist for Dabur's goal, though.
Yeah, it was deflected off a Sturm defender. And Munas Dabur on the Munas Dabur farewell tour scored the second. Dabur, he does what he does, and he angled it past Jörg Siebenhandel and 2-1. And then the third goal, Szoboszlai finally got his just rewards after a wonderful second-half performance. Andreas Ulmer found him, and then he just does it all by himself. Takes it past two or three players.
The defending of those two or three players was rather half-hearted. Didn't know what to do. They didn't really go for their challenges properly. And Siebenhandel in goal didn't really cover himself in glory either.
He didn't, but it was a deserved win in the end from Red Bull based on their second-half performance. And they are now an incredible 41 home games unbeaten, which is some record.
Lee loves the stats. I do. That's a good one.
We did, but I mean, I did post on Twitter at the weekend about the world record for home unbeaten runs in the league, and that is still a way off. That's 121 games by Real Madrid in the 50s and 60s. But honestly, if Red Bull continue to dominate the Austrian Bundesliga, it's not unthinkable that they might get somewhere close.
Yeah, they really looked, especially for me, Dabur and Rosa. Dabur ran right over to Rosa after his goal. And it really looked like, you know, these two, they're on their way out, as are some other players. They want to win everything before they go. And they might well do that. The only downside, the only sour note for Red Bull Salzburg was that Marin Pongracic, on his return from injury, lasted just 21 minutes after being substituted on. Bad news on the injury front there for him personally and for Red Bull Salzburg. However, Salzburg opened up a 9-point lead in the Bundesliga after being just 4 points ahead just a few weeks ago. They're looking rather more comfortable now. Moving down to the qualifications round, or the bottom six table in the Austrian Bundesliga, and there's another team starting to run away with it too, and that's Rapid Vienna. They beat Mattersburg 2-1 at home. We were there to bring you some audio from the stadium live. Plenty to play for in Hütteldorf today, and there's quite a good atmosphere too. The stands are looking relatively healthy. Plenty of fans have turned out to watch this time, despite the protests in Hütteldorf just a couple of weeks ago. Turns out qualifying for a cup final doesn't do your side any harm at all. There's a good buzz around the ground here. The first few minutes already underway. Tight game so far. Both sides looking to push forward. Is the first real chance, and it could be. Oh, what a clearance! Absolutely brilliant clearance on the line. It looked like Aliyu Badji was going to open the scoring early on. But after lifting it over the keeper, the ball was acrobatically cleared right off the goal line. There's a good buzz around the ground here today. It's still 0-0 after just 8 minutes. After the protests of 2 weeks ago, things are looking a bit rosier for Rapid at the moment. This game's between the top two sides in the bottom half of the table. Well, that might not sound like much, but it does mean that the battle for the Europa League playoff spot given to one team in the qualifications group is likely to be between these two sides come the end of the season. So there is plenty to play for here in Hütteldorf today. Not a massive amount of action to report back from here at halftime in Hütteldorf. No goals, and the best chances were in the early phases of the game. Richard Strebinger, the Rapid goalkeeper, hit a bizarre low-pressure clearance right against the legs of Andreas Gruber, who was closing him down. That was the closest Mattersburg got to opening the scoring, but luckily for Strebinger, Gruber wasn't able to control the ball and stick it away into the empty net. Other than that, a couple of chances for Rapid. Aliyu Badji lifted one over Tina Casali in the Mattersburg goal. That looked like it was going to open the scoring. Thorsten Maurer was able to get back and clear that one off the line to keep the scores at 0-0. Later in the game, Thomas Murg burst into the box with a nice run just when he looked like he was going to be stopped by two Mattersburg defenders. They almost left the ball for each other, allowing Murg to carry on unopposed towards the goal. He flashed his shot across the face of Casali's goal, though, rather than scoring when perhaps he should have hit the target. Mattersburg have been content to play on the break and just push forward, looking for the opportunities from set pieces with Marco Kvasina as their tall target man, but they haven't really threatened too much, if we're being honest. Rapid as well have shown a lot of endeavour, but haven't really threatened the goal too many times either. So 0-0 is probably a deserved half-time score. We're hoping for more in the second half. Time whistle's gone here in Hütteldorf. It's ended Rapid 2, Mattersburg 1. Rapid pull away at the top of the qualifications group in the bottom half of the Bundesliga. It was a deserved win for them. For the first 20 minutes after the break, the home side played with a much greater level of intensity than we saw in the first half. They threw caution to the wind and had chance after chance on the Mattersburg goal. Knas Müller and Merg were able to score two goals and put Rapid in a comfortable position. However, they couldn't add any more despite their dominance, and therefore when Alois Höller pulled one back for Mattersburg in the 89th minute after an almighty goalmouth scramble, there was always going to be an awkward 5 minutes of injury time for Rapid. Nonetheless, the game was closed out quite comfortably for them. They go away with a deserved win. 2-1, it's finished here in Hütteldorf. A third win in a row now in the bottom six for Rapid Vienna. They're starting to pull away from their direct rivals, Mattersburg. You could suggest that they might even be third in the table if they were allowed to move into the top six, but yeah, unfortunately they're locked in.
Yeah, there were some Rapid Vienna fans on Twitter joking that they had a table which had, if the table had continued as it is now, Rapid would be in third position. But I mean, they're playing 5 week teams, so...
And that says just as much about the quality of the league between sixth and third as it does about anything else. I managed to speak to the captain, Stefan Schwab, after the game to get his take on their 2-1 win against Mattersburg. For the first 15 or 20 minutes after the break, it looked like a different Rapid side. It was a very intensive performance, and really the game was won in those 20 minutes. Yeah. What was the difference after the break, and what did Didi Kubar say at halftime?
Yeah, first of all, like the first 15-20 minutes of the game, Mattersburg was a bit better. We wasn't so aggressive in the game and we had a little bit problems. And yeah, it's right from the 45 minutes till the 75 minutes. It was our best period. We was much aggressive and also better on the ball. We had more better solutions and we changed something in our build-up in the game. Like first half, we just built up with two central defenders, and in the second half, we built up like with one number six, which was coming on the last on the first line on the side, so it was 3-2 because Mattersburg played in the defense with two strikers, and that was the difference on the ball in the second half. Yeah, and it worked better then.
You mentioned this different tactical shape in the second half. There were a couple of times when it resulted in Rapid having sort of 3-2 or 4-2 even, and it looked like the squad perhaps didn't really know how to take advantage of those situations so well at first. Is that something that the squad have worked on a lot, or was it, you know, a tactical change that perhaps worked better than you expected?
No, it's important that you can change something in a game when something isn't running so good, and the coach showed us some pictures in the halftime how we can change our build-up, and yeah, then second half we did it much better and Mattersburg hadn't any solution. They was a little bit surprised, and that was of course a key for the game today.
Yeah, it was another well-deserved win today. What's the mood like in the camp, you know, heading towards the cup final? Could be the biggest game of the season for Rapid, and you're on great form at the moment heading towards that with just a couple of weeks until that happens. How important is it to keep that mood going and keep that good feeling going before the cup final?
Yeah, we're really looking forward to the cup final. It's a great game for us, and right now it's really important to find a big confidence. After every win, our confidence is getting stronger and stronger, and that's important for the cup final, that we are ready for the game. And also it's important to know that you don't lose too much games. If you win a few games in a row, it's always good. There is nothing negative like if you win games, but the important thing is just to be on the floor, because it's just 3 in a row, and we can win much more, and so we have to work on and be ready for the cup final. It will be a great game for us.
You said that you come off the pitch today with a good feeling and a lot of confidence. How do you bring that into the game next week?
Yeah, right now we have again 1 week more for the next game, so there is no English round, no game on Wednesday or something, so we have 1 week to train on, and we have to be good in the training. We have to work hard, because also the whole squad is fit now. The coach can choose around 20-22 players, so nobody can rest, and it's important that you have this mood and the trainings end in the games. And yeah, we really work hard now the next few weeks that we are ready for the cup final. That's the only thing we can do, and find good games on the weekend that give us much more confidence.
You said that everyone's fit now, there's a lot of players for Kubar to choose from. Do you think that was something that cost you in the first half of the season,
Yeah, of course. There was also troubles in the team because we had a lot of new players. It's also important that they feel like home in Vienna now. They are more than 6 months here. It's getting easier for them. And also, yeah, there was few players which wasn't fit 100%. And right now, the most are really fit. And also the coach had a whole preseason. He's just the coach since August here. So it wasn't so easy for him to have a good preseason or easy tactical things. And right now he had more than, 6 to 7 weeks in the preseason. And right now we know how he wants to play, and he knows the players are much better, and that's what we see on the pitch now. That all in all is going better and better. Every training, every discussions are clearer, and so now it's easier.
Is it a little bit frustrating looking at how some of the teams in the top six are struggling, knowing that now you guys are playing so well here in Hütteldorf?
Yeah, important is that we put it away because right now we can't change anything more. And so, yeah, it is over. Just to be focused and looking forward to the future. That's the main fact. And then the club have to find for sure the right solutions for the summer break. And then I'm sure that next season this will never happen again.
That was the Rapid Vienna captain Stefan Schwab there. I think the only thing I have to add about that game is that it's now getting a bit bizarre with Rapid Vienna. They've got this ability to blow sides away for about 15 or 20 minutes in a game. And then after that, they seem to lose their ability to keep that level up. You know, they're a completely different team between, say, 45 and 65 minutes than they were in the first half or after 65 minutes. And if Mattersburg had managed to snatch a draw at the end there, it would have been massively red faces for Didi Kubar and for the Rapid Vienna players. As it was, they've gotten away with it for now and they move on.
Yeah, it was a deserved win for Rapid, but on the other side of the coin, just like to give a shout out to the Mattersburg goalkeeper, Tino Casali, who was making his Bundesliga debut. He made a bit of a bad mistake very early on when he hit a low clearance that went out and Badji almost scored from that. But he recovered well and made some nice saves in that game, so I think he'll take confidence from his first Bundesliga appearance, and he could be an important figure for them as they chase the right to qualify for the right to qualify for the Europa League.
That's right. Moving back up to teams who are more likely to be in European competition next season. And let's look at the team in second place in the table at the start of the day. That was LASK. They played against St. Pölten, who were on a bit of a rotten run of form in the top six. And it was a 0-0 stalemate, despite St. Pölten having a man sent off. Christoph Riegler, their goalkeeper, surely the hero in that game.
Just save after save after save. LASK destroyed them almost. But Riegler was a brick wall in the goal. If you look at the LASK players, they really should have won this game. St. Pölten were down to 10 men after Robert Lubicic's two yellows. One for, very smartly stopping a counter.
Was that result due to Linz missing their opportunities, or was it due to Riegler having an excellent game?
I think a bit of both, really. Riegler was just brilliant. The amount of chances LASK produced, particularly Thomas Goiginger in the early exchanges. There's a hint of a penalty shout on the Brazilian striker Klaus, which in my opinion probably was a penalty.
He was chasing a cross in, wasn't he? And it looked like he could have tapped it in across the face of the goal, but he was sort of pulled back by his shirt as he goes to knock it in. I thought it was probably a penalty.
It was just one of those games. I mean, sometimes they happen. Post-match, Oliver Glasner was not happy on the pitch. He was shouting particularly harshly at his players, because I mean the players did everything they could apart from score a goal in the end.
Yeah,
the
their goals have dried up a bit of late though. As you say, Goiginger looked tricky, Ullmann was good, Michor looked dangerous as well, Klaus had a header that was just about saved, Ramsebner had a header as well. I don't see really what more that last
just
could
one
do.
Of those afternoons. It happens every now and again.
I would say it might not have necessarily happened had they not had those two results last week in the double setback in the League and Cup. I think this is a game that 3 or 4 weeks ago they would have won comfortably. I don't think you can really underestimate the way that could have dented their confidence, really, because they don't really have anything to play for anymore. It was all gone in a week.
Yeah, you forgive them if their morale is a little bit lower going into the game. The other game in the top six was Wolfsburg taking on Austria, two more sides who are not on a particularly good run of late. Christian Ilzer's Wolfsburg got a 1-1 draw at home against Austria Vienna. Lindor back on the score sheet there again as well.
Yeah, well, Austria Vienna took an early lead. Christoph Mornschein was fouled and he scored a penalty. That was in the 7th minute.
What did you think of the penalty decision there? I thought it was very light contact that it looked like from Lukas Schmitz there.
It was very harsh, wasn't it?
It was very light. Very light.
When you consider that Avlonitis, his foul, going back to the Red Bull Salzburg game, Avlonitis' foul on Frederik Gulbrandsen wasn't penalised.
Mm.
And also early on in that game, Schmitz was penalised.
Once that penalty had gone in, there was another penalty, which was dispatched duly by Lindl. He's had a really good campaign considering the team he's playing in.
Yeah, looking at that penalty, that was another contentious decision. Was that one of those that the referee gives it because he feels a bit bad that he's given a weak penalty to Austria, so he has to give one against them as well? Or did you think that one was more of a stonewall penalty? It was Klein just putting an arm around Nemanja Runic.
I thought you could have made a case for giving or not giving either of those penalty kicks, really. Maybe there was a bit of compensation going on in the referee's mind where he felt he had to even them out.
Yeah, soft, I would describe those penalties as. But there was another contentious refereeing decision in that game as well, wasn't there? And it involved Bright Edomwonyi getting sent off.
Yeah, towards the end of the first half, he got a second bookable offence. It was a studs-up challenge on Mikael Solbauer. It was one of those 50-50s where the ball's between two players and he really went for it. Caught him on the ankle and was duly given a second yellow card.
Which was probably doubly annoying for him because he felt that just a few minutes earlier, Mario Lightgib had gone in on a kind of almost a red card challenge on Edomwonyi. He didn't get the free kick for it and he was irate, to say the least, about that and actually got his first booking for dissent in that challenge. He'll feel like he's been doubly penalised for that. But at the end of the day, it's just yet another red card for an Austria-Vienna side who can't seem to finish games with 11 men at the moment.
Yeah, it's fifth red card in 9 competitive games. Their disciplinary record is by far the worst in the league this season. And that draw leaves them bottom of the championship round now.
Yeah, the only positive for them is that Ibbotsberger's side picked up their first point since the Meistergruppe, or the top 6 round, began, which is pretty dreadful, really. So Austria in 6th place on 16 points, Graz on 18 points, St. Pölten move up with 19 points, Wolfsburg in 3rd also with 19 points, and then of course you have last ahead of them and Red Bull 9 points ahead of last. Moving down to the bottom 6 again though, a couple of games left to round up from there. The first one had quite a few goals and a bit of action. It was Wacker Innsbruck 1, Admira Wacker Mödling 3, and Sascha Kaladzic was probably the hero in that one, wasn't he?
He's a fantastic player, and if I'm honest, I don't think he's going to be at Admira for too much longer. He scored 2 goals. He's this 6-foot striker who has pace, he's very strong, he's 21 years old, and he's in a fantastic run of form at the moment. But if I'm honest, the Wacker Innsbruck defence was just astonishingly bad.
Yeah.
Just all game, just catastrophic passes here and there.
It was exactly one of those from Christoph Freitag that opened up the chance for Kaladzic to make it 1-0, wasn't it?
Yeah, thank God it's Freitag, right?
That's what Kaladzic must have thought anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was from a free kick. Freitag pass it back to nobody and Kaladzic latches onto the ball and he calmly slotted home, had pace and strength.
Yeah, he still had a bit to do, had to beat Mack, who's been good at in the Innsbruck defence, turned him inside out and finished. But surprisingly, after over 550 minutes with no goals at home, it was actually Wacker Innsbruck who managed to get the equaliser through Daniele Gabrielli.
Yeah, Daniele Gabrielli, our favourite
non-Italian player.
Exactly. But it was an excellent goal. Took it edge of the box, top far corner, and Wacker Innsbruck were back in the game.
Yeah, where have moves like that been for Innsbruck in recent months? It was a lovely move. Involved Mack at centre-back, Dedic flowed the ball out on the edge of the box to Gabrielli, and as he said, he finished it well. If they could do a bit more of that, they wouldn't be languishing in last place, would they?
Yeah, for sure. But it didn't last long. 11 minutes later, Kaladzic got his second of the game with almost an identical goal to the goal against Altac, if you remember. It was a free kick that comes in and then Kaladzic, he beats the offside trap and heads home emphatically.
Yeah, terrible defending, really.
It's terrible defending.
To be so free in the box from a set piece, it means something's gone wrong, hasn't it, really?
Yeah.
It was a good delivery, though, from another new player at Admira, Kolja Pusch.
Yeah, a young German player. He had a great game for Admira.
And it was another Kolja Pusch free kick that led to the third goal for Admira Wacker Mödling just 5 minutes later, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, helped by more colossally terrible defending from Wacker Innsbruck. It came to Jakalis, who scored, and a 3-1 win. It could have been more as well. At the start of the game, Patrick Schmidt hit the post after, again, horrible defending. And there was also an incredible chance where Christian Klemm almost scored an own goal, then Pusch couldn't control the ball in the 6-yard box, and then Stefan Zvicic also had a chance. So it could have been 5-1 Admira at the end of the day. Brilliant performance, and Admira looked like one of the best teams in the qualification group.
Yeah, well, it's nice for Rainer Geier to see that two players that he's brought into the squad have really made an impact, because that's not the first game now that we've seen Kolja Pusch and especially Sascha Kaladzic have a real impact on Admira getting some points. That wasn't the last game in the bottom six. There was still one more, probably the worst game of the weekend, and luckily enough, we were there to cover it. It was TSV Hartberg against Cashpoint Altach, and it ended with a 1-0 away win. Heartbreak at the end for the home team, Hartberg. And we've got a bit of live audio for you from the stadium.
Full time in Hartberg, and Altach have secured a late victory. And Bergen Borussia header securing the 3 points. Lee, what do you make of the game?
Well, it was a bit low on chances, but Altach probably deserved the win. They've been really in the ascendancy since the red card we didn't spot in the first half. Zacharias Ferguson sent off for dissent. So I'd say it's probably deserved. But I really thought Hartberg were going to hold out. I'm kind of glad they didn't, because I've never seen a 0-0 game live before, and fortunately that run goes on. But yeah, I think it really was deserved in the end.
Yeah, I think it was deserved as well. And it's sending the Altach fans home in ecstasy. It's a long journey, about an 8-hour train we saw. So congratulations to Altach. We've had a great day in Hartberg, and well.
Yeah, I probably should just mention from a Hartberg point of view as well, that's 12 games without a win and over 300 minutes without a goal. So they're really in dire straits. I think they've been sucked into a relegation battle now.
Yeah, they have. And well, that's it from us. See you later.
Let's make the last train home.
That was our take on the game from the weekend. Do you have anything to add now with a couple of days of distance?
Perhaps that I should pay more attention when the referee's booking or red carding players. I had a bit of a Chris Kamara moment where I missed Zacharias Sanogo's red card as it was being given. He initially committed a foul on Manfred Fischer and then was sent off for dissent. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to report that live.
I'll forgive you. Difficult when you're live at the stadium. You're writing things down. It's easier on TV.
He was getting a hot dog. So
yeah, in my defence, I was getting a hot dog. I thought I could go and beat the rush for the halftime hot dog.
I missed the record. That says a lot about the game, doesn't it?
A classic football fan's error.
The first half was... it was a terrible game of football.
Was the second half truly any better?
No, not really. Until the 90th minute when Mergen Berisha popped up with a header to get a 1-0 win for the travelling army of Altach fans who went crazy to our right.
Yeah, they were singing, super Altach, hey. Hey, it was good. I enjoyed it from all 18 or 19 of them, however many.
I mean, it's such a journey.
Yeah, seven or eight hours, yeah, isn't it? One way. Yeah.
725 kilometres. And if you're getting there by public transport, it takes 8.5 hours.
Wow. Well, the Altach fans were rewarded with a win, at least to keep them happy on their long journey home. They've moved up to third in the qualification group. Admira are now fourth with 14 points. Hartberg have 13 points. And Innsbruck languishing at the bottom with 11 points. So that rounds up the action from this weekend's Bundesliga games. We got a bit inspired by our trip to Hartberg. A tiny village team, Hartberg have moved from the 8th tier to the 1st tier of Austrian football since they were founded in the 1940s. It's a city, technically, but a city of just 6,500 people. The club has a budget of 3.5 million euros annually to put their squad together. So it should be no surprise, really, that they're struggling a bit. But they did inspire us to look at other clubs in the top flights around Europe who've come from tiny towns and tiny villages. So after a very short break, we'll have a look at some of these footballing underdogs who have punched above their weight in the top divisions around Europe. So we're looking at footballing underdog stories inspired by Hartberg, a town of just 6,500 people. We looked at some other towns and cities who've got tiny teams in top flight leagues. Who did you find?
Well, for me, it's a team who's no longer in the top flight, unfortunately. But Auxerre have an incredible history. They're from a small town of 39,000 people. And for much of their history, they were a very unremarkable club. Then in 1964, they had a manager called Guy Roux, who took over the club and then managed them until 2005. So that's 41 years in charge.
Really?
Yeah, 41
wow.
years. And they went from a third division club when Roux took over. And he built a team over the next 16 years that finally reached Ligue 1 in 1980. The year before, they had reached their first Coupe de France final, but unfortunately lost. This humble team went on to become one of the most successful teams of the 1990s in France. They won the Coupe de France in 94 and 96 and the French League in 1996. Throw into that a UEFA Cup semi-final in 93 and a Champions League quarter-final in 97 where they lost to Borussia Dortmund. a wonderful story from a small town, and also they just did it purely by having a fantastic manager and an extraordinary youth system which brought players like Eric Cantona to the world. So fair play to Orgs there, 39,000, and they were in the Champions League quarterfinals.
Yeah, that's a perfect example, because, you know, actually, I didn't know that Auxerre was a small place, because I've only ever known them through Ligue 1, through the French top league. So, you know, you assume that with them basically being ever-present through the 90s and 2000s, that actually it was a big city. So I've learned something.
My second one is Ludogorets, the perennial champions of the Bulgarian First League. But they're slightly different from Auxerre, because they were only founded in 2001 after the former team in Razgrad, which is a city of 33,000 people in the northwest of Bulgaria. The team weren't really much to talk about until they were purchased by a Bulgarian entrepreneur in 2010, and the rest is history. So since then, they won the treble in their first season in the top flight.
Good effort.
Good effort.
Not a bad debut
and
season.
So since then, there's been 7 league titles, 2 Bulgarian Cups, 3 Super Cups, and 2 Champions League group stage appearances, including games against Real Madrid, PSG and Liverpool. So a city of 33,000. Also, they were helped by the fact that Razgrad is the Silicon Valley of Bulgaria. So they were also helped by a lot of tech companies close by.
Yeah, interesting. Lee, what did you get?
Well, I found one example present and one past. The present example is a team that's very close to my heart, TSG Hoffenheim, who I work for on a daily basis. So I've got to know them quite well. Hoffenheim is a town that has just over 3,000 people in Baden-Württemberg in southern Germany. And they've basically gone from strength to strength with the financial backing of Dietmar Hopp, who's one of their former players and also, helpfully, a billionaire owner of a software company. He's put a lot of money into the team. And in the last 18 years, they've gone up, I think, from the 9th division of German football to the very top of the Bundesliga. And they're now playing UEFA Champions League and Europa League football over the past couple of seasons. But they haven't done it, and this is what I like, they haven't done it by literally just pumping money at it. They've really taken a good approach. They had a really good first coach when they got to the Bundesliga in Ralf Rangnick, who's obviously now better known for his time at Salzburg, perhaps, for our listeners. They also signed really young, promising players like Luis Gustavo, Demba Ba, Roberto Firmino, and developed them.
Yeah, a lot of players who've gone on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, you know, playing for some of the top clubs in Europe, Bayern, Liverpool. They've really done well. And they've done it in a very innovative way as well. They've bucked some trends. They appointed the youngest ever Bundesliga coach in 2016, who was Julian Nagelsmann, who was only 28 years old. He's leaving, of course, to take over at RB Leipzig in the summer. And another thing that's really innovative that made a bit of an impression in the run-up to their match with Man City in the Champions League this season, when the club profiled Hoffenheim, was that they've had this giant video screen installed at their training ground, and Nagelsmann will basically stop them during training and say, hey, I want to watch that again. So they're really like tech pioneers, if you like, when it comes to training. So yeah, I think they're doing really well. They did finish bottom of their Champions League group in their debut season this year, but they're looking on course for a Europa League place next season.
Yeah, they were rather unlucky, I thought, in the Champions League as well. But yeah, they're really mixing it with the big boys in German football, which is pretty damn impressive for a team from a town of 3,000 people. You found one that was even smaller than that, though, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I should probably just mention briefly the Czech club, and I don't know how to pronounce this, Chemel Bisani. It sounds a bit like a curry. But I think Chemel Bulsani, I'm not really sure how you pronounce that, but it is the smallest place in Europe to have ever had a representative in a top flight league. Is basically, the club is based in a hamlet of 389 people. It's very specific, I know. And under the guidance of a prominent local businessman, they were promoted 7 times in the space of 25 years. And they've even, you know, they've produced the likes of Petr Cech and a few other notable players who represented their country on the international stage. But unfortunately, there wasn't a happy ending to their story. Just short of their 70th birthday, they folded due to financial mismanagement and the money drying up.
Oh.
So that is a sad end. But if you want to read about their incredible story, I'll post an excellent article from the Guardian newspaper on our Twitter feed next week.
Yes, find us at Other Bundesliga for more on that and more Austrian football news as well. Well, you've absolutely smashed my smallest top flight team out of the water there, because I thought you wouldn't beat this. I found Tomalice Nysiecza from Poland. Sorry about my Polish pronunciation. I believe it's Nysiecza.
Correct.
But
I've asked a Polish colleague and yes, it's that.
Well, they're from a village of just 750 people. and they reached the Polish Ekstraklasa, the top flight division in Poland, for the first time in 2015. And surprisingly, they actually managed to stay there for 3 years. They were taken over in 1994 by an architectural design company called Bruk Bet, and they gave them their blue and orange colours. The team have taken on a bit of a legendary status in terms of football fans travelling to games in Poland. Their stadium holds over 4,000 people, despite the village being just 750. Sadly enough, they were relegated last season. They are mid-table in the first division in Poland this year, but no longer in the Ekstraklasa. They did manage to finish eighth, though, the year before their relegation. So, you know, they scaled the heights of Polish football to some extent. They never managed to qualify for Europe, but still, that's a massive effort for a village of 750 people.
I was reading an article about them, and they were wondering how they might possibly attract people to a tiny village in the middle of nowhere, players and the like. But apparently one of the main reasons that attracted players there is that they were guaranteed to get paid on time, which isn't something that generally tends to happen in Polish football. So that was one of the attraction points for potential new signings.
Wow, so succeeding with money, but not quite in the way that we're used to hearing about people succeeding with money. Another team I just wanted to point out, they're nowhere near this on the scale of tiny villages, but there's probably some clubs floating around in the big leagues in Europe that not everyone will be aware that they're from such small places. And one for me is Villarreal in Spain. They're actually from a town of just 50,000 people in Castellón, and their El Madrigal stadium holds 25,000 capacity. So, you know, half of the town can fit into their stadium, which is now called Estadio de la Cerámica, in reference to the ceramics industry in the area. And they've tiled it all with yellow tiles from the region. They reached a Champions League semi-final in 2006 as well, and it was just a Juan Román Riquelme penalty at the end there against Arsenal that stood between them and the final in 2006, and they didn't make it.
Well, as a team from a smaller place, you got to a final. Who are they?
Oh!
2004?
Monaco.
Monaco, 35,000. It doesn't really count, though, does it? I mean, it's the richest place in the world, so...
Yeah, it deserves to be in this segment. It deserves a mention, at least. Did you have a few others that that didn't quite make the cut?
Yeah, Eibar, who are currently mid-table in La Liga. They're from a city of 27,000. And the smallest one in Serie A is Sassuolo, from a city of 40,000. And they qualified for the Europa League in 2016.
Hats off to them. At some point, you just got to say, well done, just for these towns, just to have a team in the top flight. Yeah, that in itself is good enough.
I mean, looking at the Premier League, what's the smallest place in the Premier League? Like Huddersfield?
Yeah, Burnley 100,000, maybe?
Burnley, yeah.
I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if there's a village team to ever make the Premier League, then... fair play to them.
Used to be back in the olden days. But yeah, Villarreal as well, I forgot to mention. They're still in the Europa League at the moment as well, playing against their arch rivals from just 30 minutes down the road, Valencia. So plenty of interest left for these small teams who are, you know, they're representing throughout Europe. Anyway, we'll move on after this to have a look at some of the other things that we saw in the last week from the world of football. So for the final section of this week's The Other Bundesliga podcast, as usual, we're looking at other things that we saw from the weird and wonderful world of football. Simon Clark, you're giggling over there in the corner, so you must have something good for us.
I just love this. So as you know, Sergio Ramos is filming a documentary series for Amazon Prime. And it's been revealed in a documentary, according to the Spanish newspaper AS, that in his house he has a replica of the famous Leonardo da Vinci painting, The Last Supper. But instead of Jesus Christ in the middle, have a guess who it is. It's Sergio Ramos.
It's not Sergio Ramos, is it?
Yeah. God,
and it says apparently there are other people on there, but the ones that you can make out are his wife and also his Real Madrid teammate, Marcelo.
Of course he would have Marcelo on there.
I find it funny that Cristiano Ronaldo is not on the painting, but I mean...
maybe he got Ronaldo painted out and he moved to
Maybe. But I just think that Sergio Ramos is almost like he's become like a figure of fun just because of how ludicrously like shithousery he is. Yeah. But the fact he has a picture of The Last Supper with him in the middle is just... caps everything off.
That might be the most classic Sergio Ramos moment.
Absolute classic Ramos, yeah.
Could you potentially find a photo of that and put it on Twitter for us? Or
you have to wait for the Sergio Ramos documentary series.
We're expecting this now. Lee, can you beat that?
No, not really.
I can't either, don't worry.
But I did find a rather good news story, and that was about a 49-year-old plumber from Ipswich, Martin Smith, being given his first international call-up at the age of 49. So congratulations, Tim. That's a nice story. Basically, he's representing the British Virgin Islands as the reserve goalkeeping coach. And basically, anybody that lives there is classed as British citizens and they're therefore eligible to represent them at international level. He was spotted while playing a match on Richard Branson's Caribbean island Mosquito.
Mosquito. Yeah. What a rubbish name for an island.
Yeah, apparently that's the name of Richard Branson's island. He was spotted there and asked to be the reserve goalkeeper. He hasn't played so far, but if he does, he'll be the second oldest international player ever after George Weah, who was 51 years old when he made his last appearance for Liberia.
It was the lucky day for that scout, wasn't it? He's chilling near Richard Branson's island of Mosquito, which I think is named like that to put people off from going there, I reckon.
I think it's named like that because it's full of mosquitoes.
Exactly, or they want you to think it is, yeah. So you don't go there on holiday. Yeah. But anyway, he's sitting there, and then this guy comes along and says, hey, by the way, goalkeeper, do you have a passport? Like, yeah, I'm British. Like, well, sorted. You're in the team. International call-up.
Not bad at 49, huh?
Wicked.
Did you find anything?
Yeah, but nothing as good as either of those things, to be honest. This was like from actual football in Serie A after the game between Milan and Lazio when Francesco Acerbi gave a shirt. He'd been talking smack about Milan all week before a big game, which is sort of billed as a battle for the Champions League spots in Serie A. And after Milan beat Lazio, there was a big brawl at the end of the match, and Acerbi tried to sort of make a peaceful gesture by swapping his shirt. And then the Milan players sort of held it up to the crowd as if, like, you know, it was like a trophy of war. So it looks like they might be in trouble for that, which is just some quite interesting images anyway of these players parading around with Acerbi's shirt. So that'll teach him to talk some smack before games, I guess.
Yeah, I did see that on BBC Sport and had a smile.
That's about it for this week's The Other Bundesliga. Thanks very much to our guests who've helped contribute for this episode on the Jesse Marsch story, which broke just before we went to record. And thanks very much to Simon Clark.
Thank you.
And Lee Wingate.
Thanks very much.
For joining me in the studio. And thanks a lot for listening in. We've got a double game week in the Austrian Bundesliga next week, so we'll be sure to update you with all the action from that on our next episode of the Other Bundesliga podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, tweet us at Other Bundesliga and let us know what you want to hear in future episodes. All music on the Other Bundesliga appears courtesy of Gabriel Geber at Torngeber Studios. For something completely different, why not check out The Amelia Project, an audio fiction podcast co-produced in Vienna.